The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, show number 273, premium for 9 July 2010.
To the Mac Observers, Mac Geek Gab. I am Dave Hamilton here in Durham, New Hampshire. Next to me, but not in Durham, New Hampshire, is...
Oh.
That's you.
Next to... I'm not next to you. Oh, well, virtually I'm next to you.
That's right.
You are on his screen.
John F. Braun here in Fairfield, Connecticut. And then back in lovely New Hampshire, we have...
Below John and Dave is Pilot Pete.
So, yes, this is our premium show. It is our first premium show for July. And again, we are experimenting with the bandwidth on Ustream, so we will be sure to remember that, and I say this as much for your benefit as it is for ours, meaning those of us that are producing this show, we will do our make every effort to make sure that any responses we make to items mentioned in the Ustream chat room are properly predicated before we respond to them. So that because we realize that most of our audience is, of course, you folks that are listening, and the chat room is filling up. But that's a good thing. So, John, let's jump right into it, shall we? With Connor,
we shall.
Is that good? All right. Let's see if we can make this work. All right, Connor, take it away.
Hello, Mac Geek Gabbers. This is Connor P with a desktop wallpaper question. I take my MacBook Pro to school every day. Well, I did. It's the summertime now. But periodically, when I would leave for a moment or turn my back, my fellow classmates, being rather malicious, would sometimes think they were being funny and change my wallpaper to some pictures of Nicolas Cage. That's a long story. But regardless, I would swiftly remove the pictures, and they would no longer be in anywhere that I could see in the system preference pane for desktop wallpapers. Then when I go to plug in another screen, that picture appears again and is the desktop wallpaper for that new screen, and I have to go change it for that. So they never actually downloaded a file per se to the computer. They browsed to the file on the web, then right-clicked on it and selected set as desktop wallpaper. So my question is there like a cache somewhere that stores these files that are used as desktop wallpapers that aren't added from the system preference pane? This is where you cut me off.
All right, so we shall cut you off. So I did a little digging, and in fact, there is a place where that particular file is stored. And you're right, once you make it work that way, it appears on any screen. I did that when we were at Macworld Expo, John. If you'll remember, we had they had a screen behind us when we did the podcast live on the show floor. And so I had taken... The desktop image of our logo. I'd made our logo into my desktop image and cleared everything off my desktop on my alternate screen so that on that big, huge screen, our logo would appear behind us, and it looked really cool. And now anytime I plug in any other screen anywhere, boom, that logo appears. Or if I remove my desktop logo, that's what appears. So I checked around and I found it. It is stored in your home folder, so it's on a per-user basis. It's in your home folder in library slash Safari slash or in the library folder, in the Safari folder, and it is called Safari Desktop Picture, and it's either .gif, .png, or .jpeg, depending on what the format of that picture is. So that's how that little bit of magic works.
Okay. So what was happening, because yeah, normally it's going to be in your system preferences, desktop preferences. So this overrules. So it sounds to me like what was happening is somebody was overruling or replacing what had been done in the preference. So he was undoing this and somebody was redoing it.
Correct.
In Safari sounds like what was happening. Okay. And I found the same thing. I looked in it and I tried this out. So, now, it's an interesting feature, though, because, yeah, so Safari and as well as the Finder, of course, if you go in the Finder,
right,
you know, you can usually well, actually from the system preference, you can set from a number of places, including what I like to do usually is from an iPhoto library. It'll make all those available. And I usually like to take some of the pictures that I've taken sure. and use those as my desktop. So, sure. But I guess the thing is now I'm curious. So of course, from the system preference, you could do this. I think from the Finder, you can do this. And from Safari, I'm wondering where else you can do this. So it sounds like there are multiple hooks right. that all affect this one setting. And yes, it can lead to what sounds like shenanigans here. And I personally don't see a problem with Nicolas Cage. I think he's a fine actor. And they could have done a lot worse. We'll put it that way.
Yeah. So in the chat room, someone was asking where the location is. And just to be clear, it's in home/library/safari/safari desktop picture. So there is actually a Safari folder inside the library folder inside your home folder. And that's where it's stored.
Yeah. Home being your. Yeah. Whatever your main username is. And then that's when right. you dig down from there. We typically refer to that. We usually started with a tilde. Which implies your home folder for the currently logged in user.
And so. In fact, it doesn't just imply it. It refers to it. If you're in yes. the terminal and you type a tilde sign, if you type like change directory space tilde and hit enter, it will bring you to your home folder. So we love that.
Great. So now, you know, this leads me. Now, again, we were wondering about, you know, how much is going to happen. But, you know, if we're going to have enough for one show, and I think we will, Dave, but yes. I've run into this before in the workplace, and the only thing I would add to this, and I think it's a valuable suggestion,
yep,
never leave your computer with an open screen, especially if you're in an environment with people like engineers and technical people or just people that want to play jokes on you. I mean, this was a rule because in the workplace, I've worked in an environment especially with people that are security people, and we would usually haze or initiate a lot of our interns. The first time they left their computer, even though they were told that this is good practice to lock their screen, it was typically on Windows machines.
Right.
So of course you can do it on a Mac. Anybody that left their computer, even for an extended period of time, we would usually teach them a lesson. Now, typically it would be changing their desktop to something hilarious.
Of course. Sometimes pictures of Nicolas Cage.
Sometimes it would be a little more extreme, like logging into their email account, which they left logged in, and sending an email to the rest of the department saying, "Hi, I'm an idiot," or you know, but something that you know was good natured, but taught them a lesson. Always lock your screen. And actually, to wind back a little bit, in a prior life, prior to the life I was just talking about, I worked in a defense capability.
Yeah.
You could actually get fired for that, and I actually knew a guy who worked, and I'm still in touch with him, who worked in the corporate computer room. His job was to look at people who had idle terminals, and he would sometimes cruise by their offices, and if their terminals were open, that was, and you can imagine, especially in a defense environment.
Oh yeah, that's bad.
That's really bad, and some people would end up getting fired.
Wow.
Well, no, I mean, what would happen is admin. Yeah. The admin would walk by their screen and he would basically put a little sticky note saying, this is offense number one, lock your screen when you leave it because, hey, I'm the good guy. But if a bad guy walks by and, you know, because if the screen's available, you could do anything, as we mentioned, from changing the desktop to sending a wise guy email to much, much worse. So,
yeah,
if you're home, I think you're cool, though. You may, you know, hey, if you got some kids that are curious, I don't know what they would do. They'd probably just, you know, maybe throw everything in the trash, but still, lock your screen, folks. When are you going to be, or set it for auto, as some people are suggesting in the room here, I think. Set your screen. I typically do this, even though I'm, you know, typically the only one in the house, I'll set my screen to typically lock after maybe, you know, 3 minutes or something like that.
Sure. Sure. Cool.
No, good topic, though. I like it.
Excellent. All right. Let's go to Roland here. Roland asked a question that we've been asked pretty frequently. It tends to come up. And the question is, there's a small group of students at my school who are interested in developing an iOS app for our school. Seeing as I run our school's computer lab and I have the freedom and resources to help them with such a project, I'd really enjoy helping them learn how to develop an app. Actually, since owning an iPhone, I've wanted to learn myself. However, I have no experience with development of any kind. I know that such things like Xcode, Objective-C, and C++ are languages that need to be mastered. Is this something I can teach myself with the right resources? If so, can you recommend any good resources such as books, websites, etc.? From listening to podcasts, I know that John's recently been wearing his developer hat, so perhaps there's something here. So I will throw out the one piece of advice I have, and then, John, I'll let you take it from there. Mm-hmm. And that is, I asked this question. In fact, this question came up at WWDC. Someone was asking, what's the best way to learn how to program? Not how to learn how to program for the iPhone, but to learn how to program. This wasn't an official conversation. This was like at some bar or whatever. And somebody chimed in and said, actually, I think developing for the iPhone is a great way to learn. And I looked at him like we all looked at him like he had his head screwed on wrong, because that's a crazy thing. And he said, well, I wouldn't say that, except there's this book called Beginning Mac Programming by Tim Isted. And he said, not only does it teach you Xcode and Objective-C, but it also walks you through very general basic development principles. And he says, it's so good that I would recommend it for someone who wanted to just learn how to program. And he said, normally I wouldn't say that about Objective-C, but with this book, it's true. And throughout the week, I asked this question of many people, and they all referred to this same book. And apparently there's a beginning iPhone programming book coming out, but it's all basically the same. I mean, there's some differences in terms of the libraries and, of course, the functionality of the devices. But as far as programming for them, the general concepts and the language is the same. So, John, go.
All right. So the thing is, I also actually came across this book. So I believe it's an O'Reilly title.
Separately, huh?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Well, in that, I believe, so you and I mean, we, and maybe I'll tell you about another goodie I got just today on my doorstep.
All right.
But I receive, you know, PR emails from O'Reilly. I believe it's an O'Reilly title. And this was one that came up, and I, you know, and they say, you know, typically if you want a copy, you know, write us. And because I, so the thing is, I am I would say a low level C type of guy, mostly Windows and other environments. So I'm certainly not a Mac programming expert, but I like to learn. And, you know, there's stuff I can take away from the Windows world. I mean, I know C, I know C Sharp, sure. Java, things like that. So it's basically, for me, it's learning the environment, not so much programming fundamentals. Plus I, you know, went to school and got these pieces of paper with, you know, that teach me the theory. But looking at Tim's book, the thing is, he does. So some parts I skip past because it's basically computer science fundamentals.
Like, sure.
You know, what's a byte, what's a bit, stuff like that. And I'm just going to toss out my suggestion here. So one, if you want to program on the Mac, number one, join the Mac Developer Program. I did this. I think a bunch of us did it. Now it used to be pretty pricey, but right now I think it's $99 for a year.
That's right.
You know, I mean, anybody should be able to afford that. And I'm going to turn off the machine that's making noise here. So join the program. But one thing you could do is that Apple offers, if you go into the, you know, developer.apple.com and you join the program and then you go into it, they have development resources and they have development videos. And then under that, so once you log into the developer portal, they'll have under development resources, development videos, which kind of step you through how to use the tools and stuff like that. One thing I would strongly suggest, which has worked in my experience, and this is what gets me up to speed when I want to learn something, is get some sample code. This is code that already works and does something useful. The nice thing is that you can take this and look at it and try to figure out how it does what it does. And even more importantly, try to screw around with it and see if you can make it do more than it does out of the box. And you will learn a heck of a lot.
Yes.
So that's one thing I'm going to offer. Now, the thing is, I don't know if I would necessarily. Now, the thing is, Tim's book, I looked through it, and so I'm not through the whole thing right now, but he does a pretty good job of going between Xcode and Mac development and development fundamentals. Now, there's no way you can cram a computer science degree into any single book. So one thing I'm going to suggest a couple of things. So one, you may want to look, if you have a local university or public education program or anything like that, you know, go to a class or something and just sit down with people that can guide you through using the tools. I can't stress enough how important it is to just get hands-on and step through the process and just see what happens. Now, what I'm going to recommend, though, is I personally do not think Xcode is a great environment to start with. If I had to start with something, and this is something that I still use, or I used for a lot of the front-end work that I did, is something, a visual tool, something like Visual Basic. Now, some people that claim to be real developers spit on Visual Basic because, you know, anybody can put something together in Visual Basic. And it actually gives you, I think, a bit too much freedom sometimes to put something together that looks terrible. I do like Xcode because it kind of enforces, or I'm sorry, Cocoa enforces you because it gives you nice, you know, basic objects to make things that look nice and Mac-like. But something I'm going to recommend that I think may make easing into program a little easier and may not require so much understanding of the low-level fundamentals is Real Studio or Real Basic.
Yep.
And I don't know if you've used this, Dave or Pete, but then I value tools that let you kind of visually put something together where you're not really too concerned about the nuts and bolts, but it allows you to put something together more from a visual point of view than a functional low-level talking to the hardware point of view. And I showed people this. I mean, some people, I remember, especially interns, like the ones I was talking about, where they're like, ah, Visual Basic, you're kidding me. And I'd be like, no, let me show you. I'm like, here, watch this. And some of them literally within 5 minutes, I could show them how to build a working Windows application. And they'd be like, oh my gosh, really?
That's pretty cool.
That is cool.
And once you get that warm fuzzy that, yes, not knowing the nuts and bolts, because it takes time. I mean, do you really need to? And then there's the question, do you really need to know about bits and bytes and, you know, pipes and sockets and all that stuff to get to develop a piece of software? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. But just again, the good feeling that you get putting something together where you can quickly put it together and make something happen and get instant feedback that something happened. I mean, the typical app I would do is I would put something together, it would have a button. It would have one field where you enter something and another field it would display something. I'm like, check it out. And I showed them how to put it together. They would enter something in one field, click the button, it would display it in the other. And they're like, wow, I did that? And I'm like, yes, you did. So
that's cool.
So I would say Tim's book is great. If you're going to take the Apple path, then you might as well start there. If you're going to take the general development path, I mean, you know, heck, you know, like I did, I started with the associates in, you know, computer science and progress down there, though that takes time. That takes 2, 4, 6 years to do that. But a lot of communities, including mine, have public education programs that'll sit you down and get you started so you can at least get comfortable with the environment. It may be Windows, it may be Mac. So I don't know if you have anything to add, guys.
I do. Augie Mendoza put the link to the book in the chat room there. And I bought it. It'll be delivered tomorrow.
Actually, that he put a different book in the chat room. Yeah, there's a couple of recommendations from the chat room. One is the books by Dave Mark, and apparently there's quite a few on Objective-C, Cocoa and iPhone programming, and then there's Cocoa programming for Mac OS X, the third edition, which is out there too. And I'm not sure if that's Dave Mark's book or not. No, that's Aaron Hillgass. So. Yeah, so there you go. So there's a couple of resources, and I think we're good. Let's
and those are good. Those are good. I would say, yeah, if you're Mac specific, because the thing is the weirdness, and just to clarify, Objective C is pretty much only an Apple thing.
Correct.
Nobody else outside of Apple really uses Objective C. It's something that's back from the next days. It's very nice because C traditionally is not object oriented. C++ is, but it was their kind of deviation from C that gave them a lot of the power of C++ without being C++. And then, of course, Cocoa is the framework that Apple offers you that gives you all sorts of great tools that can get you up and running very quickly. So so the question is, if you want to be Mac-specific, these are great titles. If you want to be more general, you may want to take a different path.
But, cool.
Good topic. All right, and we'll... No, that's great stuff. Can we save all these comments here? I want to link to all these later.
Save the links. You can save the links while I'm reading Ron's question, which I'll do right now. Ron asks, I am buying a new MacBook Pro soon and wondered if the easiest way to migrate my older MacBook data to it was to physically swap the drive to the new machine. As an old Windows user, I would never have done that since drivers and other hardware would never be compatible between machines. But since I'm now a Mac geek, I thought it might just work fine. I do have and use Super Duper, so I know I could always go that route. I used Super Duper when I upgraded my MacBook's drive to a newer 500 gig model, and the clone method worked just great. Okay, so you want to? Are you still busy collecting those links? You want me to take this one, John, and then
I can multitask. But anyways, my initial advice was because I believe he was indicating that he was starting with a Yeah, I'm going to multitask here.
So stop multitasking and answer the question.
I'm going to stop. All right. Okay. So the thing was, he said, now in general practice, cloning your drive and then bringing it over to a newer Mac, assuming the same processor,
right,
is probably a good approach. In case, though, when he mentioned that he got one of the newer Macs, and both Dave and I have been privy to information on this, he got one of the new i5 or i7 Macs. The problem is, as we touched on in a prior show, they have a version of Mac OS X that has a subtle differences in the kernel, which basically the end result is, if you try to boot from that drive that you cloned, it's not going to happen. So, in general, cloning the drive, my favorite is a carbon copy cloner, Dave. And I've done this in the past. That's normally, I think, a great approach to migrate to a new system. In this case, though, it's not going to work because the system is not going to boot.
Right.
And then I will hand it to you as to what would you do, or what's the best approach?
Yeah, so I agree that if you're migrating to a new drive in the same machine, cloning it, super duper carbon copy cloner or any of the above are the right way to do it, or certainly a very good way to do it. And that would be my preferred way. However, doing this, I would use the migration assistant. That would be the first place I would go, because the concept behind the migration assistant is it keeps the operating system the same that came on that drive and only migrates into it your applications, preferences, and user documents and that sort of thing. And Apple, you know, the migration assistant was good out of the gate. It's great now. It really, really works. And I've had so few problems migrating things in that's definitely the way I'd go. And that way you're sure not to be mucking up any of the OS components that were required for the new machine. So from one Mac to either the same Mac or at least the same model Mac, you could clone. But going to a different model Mac, I would only use the migration assistant. I would not do the clone method that we always used to use.
Now, I'm going to push back a little bit because we've heard this concern from some listeners. The problem is potentially migration assistant can, and maybe I want to modify what I, or let's talk about it.
Yeah.
Migration assistant can potentially bring over cruft that you may not need, because I think it takes a pretty, it pretty much pulls over everything that belongs to a particular user.
Correct.
So the thing is, you may bring over some drivers or kernel extensions or pref files or other stuff that you may never need. So maybe it's just a matter of having extra cruft that may, you know, take up a little extra space. And maybe the best strategy is you bring stuff over with Migration Assistant and then you see if everything works. And if it doesn't, like when I did this, recently I helped, you know, the mom upgrade from a iBook G4, which of course is a PowerPC, to a MacBook. And of course, some things just didn't work. They were too old. And normally the OS indicated this. It would show the app and it would have a big circle with a line through it, which basically meant I'm not running this. I can't. I'm sorry.
Right.
It's just not going to happen. So, other than that, it brought her over everything verbatim. I mean, it was funny because she was actually shocked. She's like, this looks like my old machine. I'm like, yes, because it brought over the desktop patterns, the icons on the desktop. I mean, everything. It was, I still think it's an amazing piece of software, although it may, again, bring over a little bit of cruft. The other option is some purists may say, I'm going to install all my apps from scratch and I'm going to bring over my documents manually. I'm going to copy my documents folder, assuming you have the discipline to just put your documents in the documents folder. And maybe that's another approach, but I think that's just creating a lot of work that's probably not necessary.
Comparing this compared to if you copy and clone everything over, you're getting all the cruft anyway. Right.
Right.
So, you know, there you go. But yeah, there is a time and a place for starting from scratch. And if, you know, getting a new machine every 3 years isn't a bad time to do it. But most of the time, it is a bad time to do it because you're, you know, busy and you got a new machine. You just want to migrate and get moving. So you know, there you go. All right.
So I say maybe if you have a recent, if you're talking not a very old machine,
yep,
then I think Migration Assistant is definitely the way to go.
Yep.
If you're talking something very old, though again, as I mentioned, my experience was positive. But if you're talking something really, really old and you're like taking it from 10.0 to 10.6,
yeah. Yeah.
Not that I think anybody's running 10.0. They may be.
I hope not. That was like Mac OS 10 beta, wasn't it?
Yes, sir.
All right. Let's go on to Gavin here. Gavin says, I have a dilemma with my iPad that I can hope you can that I hope you can help me with. My setup is as follows. And he's basically got a time capsule with an Adrobo, a Mac Mini, a MacBook Pro, an iPad, and an iPhone 3G. He says, I use my Adrobo to store all my important files, as well as a storage device for all my DVDs that I have backed up using Ripit and automatically transferred to Adrobo using Hazel. I use my Mac Mini as a media center connected to my LCD TV using 802.11g that I use for Front Row and stream my RIP DVDs stored on the Adrobo. On the Adrobo, I have all the video TS folders from the RIP DVDs, which I haven't yet converted to M4V files, and only plan to convert the movies that I want to watch on my iDevices. My Mac Mini is the Mac I use to sync content to my iPhone, as this historically has all the music, video, and apps. But now I have the iPad, which I sync to the MacBook Pro, as I'm more likely to have the both together for backup purposes. I don't want to fill my MacBook Pro hard drive with M4V files, as I like to keep it lean and mean. Is there any way I can get movies onto the iPad without copying them to the MacBook Pro? I presume I cannot sync my iPad with two different iTunes libraries. Is my only option to sync my iPad with the Mac Mini? Okay, so a couple of different questions here. Now, we're talking about syncing content to the iPad, so I'm assuming he wants to be able to view this when he's not necessarily online. And I'm in the same boat. What I use, and there is a way to do this, there's a couple of different ways. Either using GoodReader, which is an app for the iPad, or Dropbox. With Dropbox, it's relatively easy. It's easy with both. You put the M4V in a folder that's on your Dropbox, and then you sync it to the Dropbox app on your iPad. The problem with that is you'll be syncing across the internet because Dropbox does not sync locally from it'll sync locally across your network from computer to computer, but doesn't yet sync locally for your iDevices. If you remove a file from your Dropbox, from your Mac or anywhere else, it will also disappear from your iPad's Dropbox folder, even if you've marked it as a favorite ready to save. So for that reason, I don't recommend using the free Dropbox app for this purpose. I recommend using GoodReader, which I think is 99 cents, if I'm not mistaken.
It is. Yeah, it's okay. An unbelievably good deal.
Yeah, it's cheap. I know.
At 10 times the price, I would buy that app.
Yeah. So what GoodReader is it's essentially a media library. It was built to be a PDF viewer, but it does that, but it does so much more. And the cool part is not only can you store things and they're stored in GoodReader's document store, but you can pull things in from a variety of sources. So if I know the URL to a PDF, I can type that URL or paste it in and GoodReader will suck it down. If I want to pull stuff off my Dropbox, I can put in my Dropbox credentials and GoodReader will suck it down. And with GoodReader, anything that's sucked into the app stays there until you delete it from the app. You can also point GoodReader towards, you know, if you've got a web share on your Mac Mini, you could point it to that and pull content from there. One more step, and actually there's two more steps. One more option is you can put GoodReader into server mode and then mount it on your Wi-Fi network from your Mac as a document store and just copy documents there. And anything you copy there, you could copy your M4V files and they go straight across your Wi-Fi to the GoodReader app and they stay there until you delete them. And that's what I did when I wanted to watch a bunch of movies on the plane or whatever, as I just dumped them into GoodReader. I didn't have to fill up my MacBook Pro hard drive and I was able to you know, manage directly, essentially, on my iPad. Since I did that, they've now re-added USB support to GoodReader from the Mac. So you can sync not only over Wi-Fi, but also directly over USB. So that's the magic answer. So yeah, you don't necessarily want to fill up your computer and your iPad with all these movies, especially if you've got, you know, a small drive or an SSD drive in your Mac. And GoodReader is the magic answer for that. Like I said, 99 cents. I agree with you, Pete. It's a total no-brainer purchase. John, Pete, anything?
No, I don't know. What can you add? I love it.
Okay.
GoodReader is it.
GoodReader is it.
Yeah,
all
I
right.
I use it for all my flight stuff.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, sure. Flight manuals, charts. Yep. Beautiful.
I also use GoodReader. I sync, I put PDFs of song charts into it.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah. And that way, you know, I don't have to have, I mean, you can look around the studio here, Pete. There's just reams of paper everywhere. And I've started moving all that stuff to the iPad, so I don't have to, like, riffle through the paper or go into a gig or, you know, even just to a rehearsal, whatever. It's all just right there. Good
stand
to go.
Right there for the gig.
Yeah. Yeah. You put it on a stand. The iPad's got a 10-hour battery. So I just, turn off the auto dim.
Auto dim, sure.
Yeah, exactly. And then you're good to go.
So. Just don't accidentally use it as a drum surface.
Right. Don't hit it. Yeah. Although, you know, what's interesting, a little aside, and I read this advice somewhere, I can't remember where, but the iPad and the iPhone, too, works just fine inside a Ziploc bag. So if you get a 1 gallon Ziploc bag, and I do this in the kitchen, we launch the Epicurious app and we use it for recipes. And we put the iPad inside the app. We can touch it. You can move things around. It's the touchscreen totally works inside the Ziploc bag. And yet it's totally protected from spills and splashes and all that stuff. So I don't know what that tells us about our presumptions about its inductive surface or whatever it is, John. But it totally works.
I still have to explore that. We had our own Jeff Gamet actually explore this. And I think he found that, it's a capacitive display. But the thing is, it's not so much a matter of conductivity. Anyways, what Jeff found, I think, is that if he got a piece of felt, so our friend Jeff, actually, he's I would say an accomplished illustrator, yeah. And he likes drawing pictures on his iPad, but he had a problem because he would typically be resting his palm, and the thing is, the display, of course, in the iPad, as with any Apple device, will detect that. And he was like, how do I get it to not recognize this? So a little tangent here, which we haven't done one for a while. But anyways.
Aren't we on one already?
Tangent to a tangent. But he was saying, how can I avoid this? And so he asked the question, does anybody know of a non-conductive material I can use to shield me? Now, the thing is, I don't think he was necessarily characterizing the problem correctly, because I was like, well, how about paper? Because paper... Last I checked, paper doesn't really conduct too well.
Right.
And that I don't think it does. I mean, it's actually an insulator, if anything. But I tried this on my iPod Touch or iTouch, which drives some people nuts. And sorry about that. I just think it's condensing the term. But anyways, I tried a piece of paper and I'm like, wow, it's picking that up. So it's...
Yeah, but two pieces of paper, no.
And actually, I tried this. So with a thick piece of cardboard...
Yeah.
So what I actually had a holder for a Starbucks gift card. And if I folded that on itself a couple of times, that was thick enough. Now, what he found was actually a piece of felt. So I think it's not so much that whether what you put on there is conductive, but if it's thick enough to maybe not sense the pressure of you just pressing down on it.
No,
I still got to look into
it.
No,
it's not. No, we tested this. It's not pressure.
You did.
Yeah, no, you and I did. I think we did it. We certainly did it before a show.
Little
we may
bit.
Have done it on a show, but no, it is not pressure. It's it's something more than that.
I'm just not an electrical engineer,
if your
so I don't
wet or something like that. It's different.
Yeah, it's something. Yeah, because I'm pushing real hard through a couple pieces of paper and nothing. So so I'm not sure what it is actually.
Well, maybe it is. Again, I don't have enough doubly knowledge to know this. So I don't know if it's conductivity or capacitance or inductance or whatever. But in general, I found that something thin like a piece of paper did not prevent the iPad or iPod Touch from sensing that something was happening.
Right.
But Jeff found that a piece of felt worked very well. Now, there's also, and I think we suggested this, he didn't have them available. They make actually, I think several people make special gloves. Especially fingerless gloves that just cover your palm, but they leave your fingers available so you can illustrate. And I think that would probably solve the problem as well.
Yeah, it could. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Oh, on a Tony. Like this one.
Yeah.
Because I figured this one out. So.
Tony writes, I've had two background processes running and half-heartedly tried to resolve this, but got serious recently. One was from an installed app called Spring Cleaning. A scheduler kept launching and shutting down every 10 seconds. I uninstalled it and trashed the remnants. That one worked. The one that is persistent is from a Color Monkey demo I had installed, and that's Monkey M-U-N-K-I, just like it sounds. I uninstalled using, I think, AppZapper, and thought the problem was fixed. As you will note, in my console logs, this problem carries on. I found a few Color Monkey pref scripts. I trashed them all. Still, no joy. And indeed, Tony sent along, she sent along the console logs, and it was showing that Color Monkey or something was trying to launch Color Monkey and then dying after 10 seconds and then coming back around and then dying and coming back around. So John, go.
Here's what was happening. So I actually was able to figure out what the problem was here.
Yeah.
So looking in the logs, what was happening is it was identifying that the process responsible for trying to do this was com.apple.launchd.per user. And it would basically go through this endless cycle of saying throttling respawn. Then it would say POSIX_respawn and the name of the Color Monkey process. And then it would say no such file or directory. And then it would say exit. And it would keep doing it like every 10 seconds. So on the one hand, I don't think that's a big deal. I do not think this was something that would drag the system to its knees. It was every 10 seconds trying to launch this thing. Now, the thing is, to step back a bit, what is LaunchD, you may ask?
What is LaunchD, I believe?
What is
LaunchD? Well, I don't know. No, LaunchD, I believe, is kind of the launcher of all processes under most Unixes. But OS X and LaunchD, I think, is something early in the boot process, is something that will launch pretty much everything else. I think to kind of put it in a nutshell,
it sort of becomes the parent process of everything else. That's right.
Right. Now, the thing is, it will launch all sorts of things. Now, how do you know? Now, in this particular case, I found a specific solution to this problem. So in this case, what was happening is this was a file that was in, hold on.
So just to be clear, and I had to look this up after you said it, John, was you said LaunchD is in a lot of Unixes. It was actually developed by Apple to be used in Mac OS X 10.4. Yeah, I didn't think it was used previous to that, but yeah, just to clarify, it is an Apple thing, but it's now an open source framework that anybody could use. Yes.
And I think Apple, actually, what happened is, I think in the past you would have multiple programs launching things when you booted the system. And I think Apple encouraged people, you know, let's all center on LaunchD as being the one application that launches everything when the system starts up, so we don't have this big mess. I think that was what encouraged them to do that, and that's great. But anyways, so for this specific problem, the problem is, if you look in, like we mentioned, tilde or your home directory /library/launch agents, if you look in that directory, you're going to see a bunch of files in there. All of those files in there, their purpose is to try to launch a piece of software on startup.
Right.
Now, the thing is, LaunchD normally is very persistent. And if what is in that directory is something that doesn't exist, it's going to try, as we've seen, every 10 seconds until eternity to try to launch it again. Now, again, as we mentioned, it's not going to drag your system down, but it can, if anything, it's going to clutter your console, and that's bad. So basically, I suggested to Tony, look in this directory, and I'm sure what happened is that she found something with the name Color Monkey in it, deleted it, and actually she wrote back and said, yes, I deleted it, and the message went away. Now, to look at the bigger picture, Dave, you may want to get something, and actually I haven't seen it updated in a while, but I think it's a very nice utility. Lingon.
Yeah, I love Lingon.
And Lingon, what Lingon is Lingon is like the application to let you look at all your LaunchD applications. And for example, I launched Lingon just to look at this. And if you launch Lingon, you will see that it has different categories. And actually, this process, along with all the processes in this particular directory, are listed in a category called My Agents. Now, Lingon also lists pretty much. Now, you got to be careful, because Lingon is going to show you the guts of Mac OS X and what it's launching in order to get itself basically in an operational state. That's what LaunchD does. LaunchD is taking all these other files everywhere and launching these applications so you can use your computer. So if you're going to use Lingon, look, but be very careful if you're going to touch.
Yes.
Now, what I saw in Lingon is actually it did have a feature where you could highlight one of these scripts and actually say enable or disable. I don't know if it sets. I think it may be setting the executable flag on it or something, but But it sounds to me like what happened is that Tony went and just actually removed the Color Monkey. I think it's usually a plist file, and the problem went away.
Good.
So that, Lingon has not been updated in a while. I think it hasn't been updated in a couple of years.
It's a dead duck in terms of updates, but it still works because it works. The locations of all this stuff hasn't changed. As soon as Apple changes the location of it, you know, if in 10.7 they put it, somewhere else, it's over.
Looks like you can really goober your system with Lingon.
Oh, I love it, though. It's great.
Really powerful.
But, you know, if you just, again, look and don't touch or modify anything, it shows. I mean, this will give you a deep understanding of what is involved in starting up your machine so it gets to an operational state.
Well,
I think it's great.
Lingon's one of those programs that I always mention when I'm doing my Running Your Mac Lean, Clean, and Mean session, which I do at user groups and Macworld Expo, because it's so powerful. But the caveat I mention every time is, hey, look, if you don't know what it is, Google it before you remove anything.
Before you cut its throat.
Yeah, just, you know, if you don't know what it is, Google it. And if you still don't know what it is, leave it alone. Don't drive, you know, why open that door? Just leave it alone. And it's that simple. So, all right, is it time to move on to Jim?
Jim thinks so.
What else is it time for?
Jim says, in an effort to clean up my desk, I would like to have one large external hard drive partitioned such that half of the drive is delegated to Time Machine and the other half is a daily clone backup using Carbon Copy Cloner. I've attempted this with two new hard drives, both of which eventually failed to work. Since they failed by different mechanisms, I'm not sure it had to do with the partitioning. It may have just been two bad drives, but I'm reluctant to order another one without being sure that I have not been part of the problem. The first drive was an iOmega Prestige 1 terabyte USB hard drive. I was able to partition it without difficulty, but it immediately began to make clattering noises as if the drive was dying. Tech support thought it was the power supply and offered to send me a new one for me to install. I just sent the thing back to Amazon. Then I decided I would get a more expensive hard drive, and I went with the LaCie 1 terabyte USB desktop external. It did not like to be partitioned into two partitions, but I finally accomplished it. At first it would mount, then it failed to mount. Tech support thought it was a bad drive. I sent it back to Amazon. Before I'll order another hard drive, I'd like to be sure that my partitioning is not causing any problems, and I've just been having a run of bad luck. John, from my standpoint, this is an odd set of circumstances and certainly it's certainly worth questioning. But in my experience, there's no reason that partitioning a drive into more than one partition would cause any physical damage. Certainly not to the power supply and probably not even to the drive. I mean, all drives are partitioned. It's just in this case, there's one additional partition that he's using. So. I can't think that him partitioning it would play any part in the drive dying.
I agree with you. I think the only thing both you and I came up with, the only thing you want to make sure of is when you get the drive. Now, the thing is, I think a lot of these drives sometimes are probably not formatted
for the Mac.
In the ideal format to be used on a Mac.
Yes.
And the way you want to get around this, and I think I actually have a screenshot, or you mentioned this, Dave, but no, here we go. So if you run disutility, so this is what I would recommend. If you get a drive from anybody, unless they are people that explicitly say this is a Mac drive, and you're not always going to run into that with a lot of these guys.
Sure.
They're probably going to ship it as a NTFS or, you know, FAT or whatever. So what you want to do is when you get the drive is reformat it, maybe copy whatever is on there. There may be something useful, probably not.
Sure.
But if you go to disutility under the partition tab, there is then going to be a button options ... And if you click on the options ... button, you're going to see the following. You're going to see three choices. You're going to see GUID partition table. For the most part, with any modern Mac, this is what you want. And actually, the description, I'll, you know, go through it right here. Basically, GUID, to use the disk to start up an Intel-based Mac or to use the disk as a non-startup disk with any Mac with Mac OS 10.4 or later.
Right.
So I would say for the most part, unless you're 10.4 or earlier, that's what you want. Now, there's another one, and this actually applies to me because I still have my dinosaur here, the G5. Apple partition map is the other option. That is if you have a power, again, if you have a dinosaur like I do, a power PC based Mac, that's the partition scheme that you want. And then there's also master boot record. That's the third one. That's if you got a DOS or Windows disk. And you should rarely be choosing that, especially if you're using the disk on a Mac. So the only thing I could imagine, Dave, is that it was. But even then, I can't see a faulty partition. I mean, the Mac will either see the disk or it won't. Even if if it's Apple Partition Map or Master Boot Record, it'll still see it. But yeah, I agree with you. There's no way. I mean, you remember the bad old days when you had to actually configure the cylinders and the heads and but we're way beyond that. I mean, I could think in those days, if you got that wrong, then the disk controller would try to make the drive do things it wasn't meant to do, and maybe you could destroy the drive.
Yeah, maybe.
I think it's unlikely, but no, I think he just ran into, millions of hard drives are made every year, and you're bound to get one of the bad ones.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate. I've been lucky. I don't think I've ever gotten a drive. Yeah, again, knock on wood, and now, of course, everything's going to come crashing down.
Not yet.
But I've never yet. Now, typically, I haven't used a drive, probably for, longer than 3 to 5 years before I move on and,
That's good advice, actually. Don't rely on a drive that's more than 3 to 5 years old. Certainly that 5 year mark.
Without a back, strong backup. Double layered.
That's right. Approach. That's right. Yeah. All right. Let's listen to what Taylor has to say. I guess I could have just played that, huh, John? Are we ready? We're ready, right?
I'm ready.
All right, go.
Hi, John and Dave. I've got an interesting time machine problem that I'm hoping y'all might be able to help me solve. I've got a kind of a complicated setup. I've got a Drobo, an original USB Drobo that I've fully stocked, and I've got it partitioned into three partitions. I'd found instructions how to do this. He'd set up the first one partition I've got that I use for a time machine partition for my 27-inch iMac, and I've got a second partition that I use for the time machine backup for my wife's MacBook, and a third partition I use for all remaining storage, and that gets expanded whenever I add hard drives to the Drobo. Now that setup has worked great. I had the Drobo connected directly to my 27-inch iMac running Snow Leopard. Worked great. Time Machine was working from my iMac. Time Machine was working from my wife's MacBook, connecting over our wireless network at home to the Drobo that's attached to my iMac. Now the problem has arisen that I've got an old Mac Mini G4 that's running Tiger that I want to use as kind of a home server. And so I've got the Drobo connected to that Mac Mini now. And, of course, the Mac Mini sees the Drobo and sees all three partitions, no problem. But the problem is the MacBook and the 27-inch iMac are unable to have Time Machine back up to those Drobo partitions. And the problem that I'm getting is this. I'm doing this on the 27-inch iMac. I get a Time Machine error. It says the backup disk image slash volume slash iMac TM2 -1 slash Taylor 27 iMac dot sparse bundle could not be created. Error 1.
All right, and I'm going to stop it right there because that's the issue, and that's the part I wanted to get to. When you're seeing it referring to a disk, anything but the internal drive is considered to be a subfolder of slash volumes on your Mac. And that's just a way of Unix doing its thing. So that's totally normal. What you should see is anytime the OS is referring to a disk, it's going to say slash volume slash, and then the name of the disk pretty much as it appears on your desktop. In this case, his disk is named iMac TM2, but the computer is referring to it, or it's looking for iMac TM2-1. And it's that -1 that he mentioned that's really the trick here. And the issue is if you have it in the volumes folder, what happens is when you mount a new disk, it creates the Mac creates a subfolder in the volumes folder with that name and then links the disk to it. It's a little bit wonky, but that's how Unix works. So what happens is it might look in that folder, and if there's a folder already named, in this case, iMac TM2, well, then it has to create another folder with a different name. So it puts a -1 or a -2 or a -3. If you start seeing that happening, eventually things are going to get confused because it is going to start to wipe out those other folders. It's not going to link the drive to the dash one, the dash two. It's going to link it to the main iMac TM2 at some point, and now things aren't going to be found. So the magic answer is, in theory, relatively simple, but you must be careful in practice. So the first thing is you want to eject all your external drives, or certainly all the instances of this particular drive, and disconnect it from your Mac just to be safe. Then look in your volumes folder, and the way to get there is in the Finder, to go up to the Go menu, choose Go to Folder, and type in /volumes. Once you're there, you should see a list of all of the drives that are mounted, and you're going to leave those alone. And then if you see other drives that aren't mounted, especially with these dash one, dash two, but even if there isn't the dash one, if there's the name of a folder for a drive that's not mounted, just throw it away. And once you've done that, then remount the Drobo. It should appear in the volumes folder. You'll see it appear there. It'll also appear on your desktop. The names should be exactly the same. And once they are, you've got to go back in because Time Machine is now looking for that drive with the dash one. So you've just got to tell Time Machine, nope, go look here. And it's going to pick up your old backups. You're not going to have to start from scratch, but you've just got to repoint Time Machine. So you go into System Preferences, Time Machine, and click, I believe, Change Disk, and point it at that new drive. And then from then on, you should be good to go. But yeah, as soon as you start seeing that dash one appear, either in your volumes folder or somewhere else, that's when you know you've got some confusion happening and you got to clear it out. That's my story anyway. I'm sticking to it.
Mm. I'm with you.
All right. Hey, you got anything to add to that, John, or is it?
Not really.
All right.
I've never run into it.
Oh, really? Well, you don't run a lot of external drives. Is that right?
Nope. The only one I have is my occasionally, but no, for Time Machine, I use Time Capsule, and I've never seen that happen with that. So
I have quite a few external partitions that I use, and I don't run into it all that regularly, maybe once, maybe twice a year. You know, if a drive gets disconnected and then reconnected in the wrong way, that can certainly happen. So
And as far as partitions, you know me, I don't like partitions, man.
I know.
Why? Just put it all in one disc, man. Makes your life easy.
Pete's got a question.
I do have a question.
What?
These were great questions, and I'm wondering if I wanted to submit one, how would I do that?
There you go. Yeah, wise guy.
What a guy.
Yes, that's a good question, Pilot Pete. So you could call us at 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is...
4-3-3-5.
Did you get
that?
You know
what you could do?
4-3-3-5.
That's right. That's
okay. But I think the best way is you could send an email, and since you're listening to the premium feed, you probably want to send an email, Dave, to premium@macgeekab.com.
Did you say right? premium@macgeekab.com?
I was asking you, but I do believe it's premium@macgeekab.com is where you want to send an email, which could just be text, screenshots, and a reminder, like even some of the questions we've gotten. Try to be as specific as possible. Like we've had people write in and say, I got a printer. Which printer? Like we had that come up in a prior show. Somebody said, I got a printer and it's not working. Tell us which printer it is. It helps. So as much detail as you can give us about your OS, your computer, and the model number of the device, the ports. That's another one. Like we had a question in the past. Is it a network printer? Is it a USB? Whatever. So to the best of your ability, if you can describe the device or give us a model number or something like that, it's really, really helpful.
And I'll throw something in. And unlike my friend, Mr. Braun here, my dear friend, Mr. Braun here, try to be as concise as possible with your questions because that does allow us to read them on the air. So be specific and concise and pithy at the same time.
Are you saying I'm not concise?
Well, you just rambled a little bit, so I thought that was kind of a funny little thing to say.
Well, Dave, I really don't think I ramble much. I mean, I'm usually pretty direct in... kidding. What else we got here? iTunes comments. We love them. Leave them. Positive, negative, constructive are good. But
And there's a Skype line at Mac Geek Gab. And Pete, I think you had something you wanted to add here.
Quick shout out to Fred Clausen at Albuquerque Center, one of the listeners. Connected with him on the radio. So
hey, cool.
Yeah, Fred
on the radio.
Thanks for listening. Yeah.
What kind of radio?
Victor Hotel Foxtrot VHF around 133-75, I think, in the Albuquerque Center area.
Oh, VHF. Is that VHF?
Yeah.
It's VHF. Oh, yeah. We've done that. I've done that.
Very cool. Awesome. So I am on vacation next week, so we will not be podcasting next week. If any of you are attending the Rush Show or live near Mohegan Sun Casino in Connecticut, we'll be doing something before the show on the 19th. You know, maybe getting together in the bar for a drink, depending on how many people there are. I don't know. Tweet us. Contact us. Oh, tweet us. Dave Hamilton is me on Twitter. John F. Braun is him. Pilot Pete is him. And, of course, Mac Geek Gab is all of it. And that's it. We Have Communicators is Michael Johnston's podcast. He converts this show to AAC for us and for you. And, of course, all the bandwidth is provided by Cashfly, C-A-C-H-E-F-L-Y. And with that, John, I think I'm almost done with my work week here and ready to head out on vacation. I think I've got a couple things to do. So. All right.
So with the Mohegan Sun, are you getting the presidential suite? Or
I'm staying down the road. That place is way too expensive, man.
Mohegan? Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They want like
a hotel at a casino is expensive? I remember the last time I was there, Dave. I believe the cash machines default to giving you $100 bills.
As well they should.
It's even more expensive if you play in a casino.
All right, have a good week, everybody, and we'll talk to you when we get back.